Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Before Title 42 was put in place, America faced a flood of migrants at our southern border seeking asylum. When the pandemic broke out, Title 42 was enacted in an effort to curb the spread of COVID-19. Well, that emergency is over, and Title 42 ended last week. It was anticipated that would result in the border, our southern border, being inundated, and officials in border towns and elsewhere were busy making preparations to deal with a surge of people, something that would exacerbate an already challenging humanitarian crisis. Well, that surge didn't occur. In fact, crossings dropped 50% after Title 42 restrictions ended last Thursday. Still, officials say they detained 6,300 migrants last Friday and about 4,200 on Saturday, down from more than 10,000 just before the regulation expired. That's still a crisis for border towns and for cities and towns far away from the border, including Charlotte, where preparations to receive some of these individuals are underway. Here to tell us more about that and what the end of this policy means for the country and this region is Kayla Young, a Report for America Corps member covering issues involving race, equity, and immigration for WFAE News and for La Noticia. Welcome to the program. Good to see you, Kayla.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Jamila Espinosa is also with us. She is an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. Thank you for being with us again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
And Dee John is Director of Community Outreach and Development at Camino Health. That's a bilingual and multicultural health center focusing on primary care, behavioral health, health and wellness, and food security. In other words, a lot. Thank you for being here, Dee. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let me start with you. It was estimated that tens of thousands of people would swamp our southern border last week, the moment Title 42 ended. As I mentioned, it didn't happen. Crossings dropped 50%. Did that come to all the people that you talked to in the course of your reporting? Did that come as a surprise?
I would say there was a lot of uncertainty leading up to the end of Title 42 and what that would mean for arrivals and people being allowed into the country. And so we had a lot of organizations locally trying to build up their resources in the case that we did have a sudden large arrival of people. But there are a few factors that come into play the same time Title 42 ended that I think are contributing to the lower numbers we're seeing right now. With the repeal of Title 42, we revert back to Title 8, the former policy used to process people. And the idea is that this might lead to more rapid deportations at the border. Title 42 wasn't really used to deport, it was used to turn people away. So we saw a lot of repeat border arrivals under Title 42. The other thing that we're seeing is an attempt to implement a new asylum policy that might make it more difficult for people to declare asylum in the U.S. And I think probably some of our Jamila might be someone who can explain the ins and outs of what that policy means.
And we're going to get to that. But Jamila, before the show started, I asked you, I asked just in general, if people understood why this great influx of people did not materialize. Kayla kind of explained a lot of it just a moment ago. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think Kayla hit a little bit about it. So what we see is that migrants do want to enter the United States and seek asylum, and they want to be able to have an opportunity to remain in the United States legally. They want that chance and that opportunity not to live in the shadows, but to do things the right way. So many people think that migrants come in here and they want to illegally cross and then live in the shadows, and they don't. They want to come here and obtain work authorization, pay into the social security system, and be able to call the U.S. home. So we see is, as Kayla mentioned, we are now reverting back to Title VIII. And with Title VIII comes consequences, comes not only punishments under the immigration laws, but also they can face incarceration in federal prison. With Title 42, they were commonly referred to turnbacks, which is what Kayla's referring to is, you would have someone try multiple times under Title 42 to enter the United States, but they didn't face those punishments. They weren't seeing those immigration consequences that if you crossed illegally, you would be punished for 5 years for being able to seek any type of immigration benefit in the future, or face those federal consequences of being imprisoned. Under Title VIII, now you do face those punishments. And so what we see is Customs and Border Patrol has opened their CBP One app to more than 1,000 daily appointments.
That's a telephone app that you make an appointment.
It is a telephone app, and there's definitely a lot of kinks that need to be worked out. It crashes frequently. You have limited technology with the migrants. You know, they have small data plans, and it can only be done on smartphones. The 1,000 daily appointments are gone within seconds. Literally, they sit there at 9 a.m., they wait for these appointments, and they're waiting for months. So what we see is that these migrants want to play by the rules. They actually don't want to cross illegally. And I think that is what's playing a factor into the decrease in numbers right now.
We're using a bunch of words that people who don't follow this closely may have a limited understanding of, and one of them is asylum. Can you give me an official legal definition of what someone seeking asylum is actually seeking and why?
Yeah, absolutely. So asylum is, someone has to be one in the United States. And so sometimes people want to say, well, why are they coming into the United States illegally? Why aren't they doing it the right way? And so someone that seeks asylum is facing persecution in their home country. Either they've already faced persecution or they have fear of future persecution. And so some that we are seeing that we typically haven't seen in the past are people are making their way from Europe, Ukrainians, Russians. We don't really have to explain necessarily right to our audience why they may be fleeing Ukraine or Russia, because it's largely due to the war. But that's one example of the populations that we are seeing, more recent arrivals that are people we weren't seeing previously. And that you can seek asylum because of persecution based on your race, your religion, your national origin, because you belong to a particular social group. We won't get into all the nuances of what that means, but that can mean essentially that you might be because of your sexual orientation. So that would be a particular social group or your national origin. We're also seeing a large influx of people because of their political opinion, seeing a large influx of Venezuelans and Cubans, which are not a population that we saw previously. During previous administrations, we had a large influx of Central Americans. The groups that we're seeing now, were due to political unrest in their country, is that political opinion. So you have to fall within one of those five categories and be in the United States to seek asylum.
This is so multi-layered, and as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, people from Venezuela, Cuba, all over the world come across our southern border to seek asylum. They have to come in through Mexico. Here's a question I've never heard an answer to, because I've never heard the question asked. Why does Mexico let them in?
Absolutely, and that's something that the United States is, that we understand through recent press releases that the Department of Homeland Security and the Biden administration now recently has come to an agreement that Mexico will begin to accept Title VIII removals from Cuban, Haitians, those from Nicaragua and Venezuela. Due to our political relationships, that means the United States with these countries, we have not been able to necessarily remove people to Cuba and Venezuela. And so once they arrive in the United States, it becomes very hard for the U.S. government to send a plane to Cuba or to Venezuela due to our political relationships. So what the United States has done is essentially come up with diplomatic agreements under our understanding to press releases with the Department of Homeland Security for Mexico to accept the people that they allowed to enter into their country. And then through them allowing them to enter into Mexico, now they are forcing them to take them back. What I will say is we do see here people that have been deported from Mexico. So sometimes we do see people that manage to be deported from Mexico back to their home country, but then manage to make it back across the southern border. So it's not that Mexico doesn't necessarily ever deport people from their country. It's just that there's such a large influx that they too themselves have a challenge, I believe, of handling the migrants that come across their borders.
Kayla, you wanted to chime in on this too.
Yeah, and I wanted to add regarding passage through Mexico that people that I've spoken to on my beat that have made that journey through Central America, sometimes starting in South America, many will say that Mexico was one of the hardest parts of the journey, and that there is a lot of law enforcement going on in Mexico searching for migrants. I spoke to one Venezuelan woman who said they didn't want to take the bus in Mexico because they were worried about officials getting on the bus to request immigration paperwork. So I do want to add that there is a lot going on the ground with migration in Mexico as well. And that migrants will tell you that's a very fearful part of the journey for them. And I'd also add that even though we're seeing a lot of people arrive to our border trying to get into the United States, a lot of migrants stay closer to their home country. If we look at global numbers of migration, most refugees tend to live in a neighboring country. And we do see that a lot of Latin America has taken on migrants and refugees of their own. But something I hear from people recently is that with COVID and the economic impacts of that crisis, there are people now leaving those countries where they had tried to settle originally. So maybe they went to Colombia to seek refuge. And now the economy there has become quite complicated as well, and they're looking for a second option.
People crossing our southern border, the numbers have increased substantially over the last decade or so. And one of the things that gets lost in all of this, I think, is why they're coming and what has moved them to make this dangerous, arduous journey. I mean, if you look around the United States at places that are inundated by natural disasters and you watch the people on the news saying, yes, I lost my home, I lost everything, but I'm staying put. You have to understand that it takes a lot to move you away from your home, whether it's a homeland or the actual physical place where you live. So what are the conditions, Jamila, that are driving these people to take what is, I think, is a drastic action?
Absolutely. And I think it's really important for viewers and listeners to understand that the recent arrivals that we're seeing sometimes have absolutely no connections to the United States, which is very different from previous migrant stories. That is why we're seeing large numbers when you see migrants living in shelters in New York City. How is it that they're coming to the United States and they have no ties? And that is because the conditions are just that dire in their country. They are being persecuted because of their political views. Venezuela, for example, we have seen entire families have to relocate because they oppose the dictator of the country. They could have had one member of the family who was politically active, and their entire family now is unable to obtain food, is unable to obtain medical care just because one family member was a participant, right, of opposing Maduro. And as a result, those are the type of things that cause people to flee, leave everything, and come to the United States with absolutely no ties.
That is Jamila Espinosa, with an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. Kayla Young is here with WFAE and La Noticia and Report for America. And when we come back, we talk to Dee John, Director of Community Outreach and Development at Camino Health. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the migration to our southern border and the end of Title 42, which was predicted to have or create an influx of migrants. It did not, or it hasn't so far, and it's only been since last Thursday, so we'll have to see what happens going forward. We're talking about it with Jamila Espinosa, an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law, Kayla Young, a Report for America co-op member and reporter for WFAE News and La Noticia, and Dee John, Director of Community Outreach and Development at Camino Health. All three of you have heard stories from the people who have made these arduous, dangerous, often fatal journeys as they lose members of their own family on the trip from their home country to the United States for those who get in. Dee, you help set up survival services for these folks when they arrive here, and they arrive here with practically nothing. So what have you heard from them about their reasons for taking this trip? And did what occurred to them along the way surprise them? I'm sure they don't have the kind of media coverage that we do of these trips that we've seen on television recently. So what surprised them about what they faced as they made this trip? Do you know?
So I think what's really important to know is that the way that Camino is classifying a newcomer is somebody that has recently come through the United or to the United States border from January 2023 until now, but they have just arrived in North Carolina. And so the people that we are currently serving as newcomers have been here for days or hours. And so what they're coming with is mostly what's on them. So it may be clothes, it may be shoes, maybe a backpack, but that's really it. And so they don't have cash, they don't have IDs, they don't have many things that would help them navigate and integrate back into the community. And so something that Camino has heard in over the last really 2 weeks, we've served 102 individuals over the last 2 weeks. And something that we've really recognized is that they have spent everything along their journey just to make it to the United States. And the average cost for most of them is about $5,000 just to make that journey. And it's over a course of several months. And so, and a lot of them have no connections to the United States or to North Carolina when they do arrive.
And why do they choose to come here as opposed to some other South American or Central American country?
So from what we really know is that they're fleeing violence, extortion, political reasons, religious reasons. Reasons. And then also what we've seen is they want more opportunity. And so just as Jamila said, we're seeing a lot of Venezuelans and Cubans now where we weren't seeing them before. Last week, I would say 80% of the people that we served, 65 of them, were Venezuelan. And so that's pretty high in comparison to what we've seen before.
Jamila, the United States gets itself involved in a lot of things around the world, a lot of conflicts, etc. Are we doing anything in the countries that seem to have the problems that are driving these people to our southern border to help alleviate those problems? Are we involved in any of these countries in any way to fix the problem that is causing the migration?
Secretary Mayorga and the Biden administration has been funneling U.S. funds largely into Central America, to Honduras, to Guatemala, El Salvador, which were largely the countries that we saw first initially through the Obama administration, then through the Trump administration, that were the largest influx of migrants. And so what we saw is that they were strengthening those relationships with those countries in to create safer. What we were seeing was the migrants were fleeing those countries largely due to criminal activity, cartel, drugs. There was just too much violence in their countries. The drug cartels and the gangs had overrun their countries, that they were no longer safe. Their children could not attend school, and that is why they were fleeing. So what we've seen is that the partnerships with those countries have been to help reinforce the security in those countries. And that is why I believe, my opinion, and based on some of the data, we may see, that's why we see largely some of those numbers decreasing from some of those countries, because we're seeing, you know, we hear from the president of El Salvador that he is, and there's, you know, different issues there with human rights issues on how they're treating necessarily gang members in their countries. And there's a whole different topic there. But what we do see is that there's safeguards being put in those countries. However, now we see political unrest causing a new wave of migration from other countries. And a little bit on why people don't necessarily relocate to other countries, if I can touch on that, is we see often high discrimination. Venezuelans fleeing to Colombia are so discriminated against in Colombia that they cannot seek jobs, shelter, they're homeless because they're not wanted, even though we think, oh, they're Spanish-speaking countries, they'll be welcomed. They are not welcomed. And we see that not just in the US, but around the world, migrants are not welcomed when they go to other countries. And so the same thing we see here, you see around the world, in that they go to another country and they're not welcomed. And that is why they cannot resettle or seek asylum in other countries.
Kayla, we have spoken for years on this program and other programs about our broken immigration system in this country, one that needs fixing, and no one seems to have the political will to even begin a discussion about it. We know that our economy needs migrants in order to be successful, but with 3,000, 6,000, 10,000 people seeking and coming across the border every day, and more probably sneaking across the border, is that sustainable? Can you bring in that many people per day, 365 days a year, and not overwhelm all of the support systems that we have available in this country, Kayla?
Yeah, it's a really complex question because, you know, as Jamila and Dee have mentioned, a lot of people arriving now have really complex needs. We have a lot of people arriving to the Charlotte area that don't have family or connections here. So we're seeing, from what I've gathered, more individuals who are at risk of homelessness, who have really essential, urgent needs. And so when I think about this question of, is it sustainable? Are we able as communities to take on this humanitarian need? You know, I don't know that we have the choice but to confront these needs, because we are connected to a larger region, and we're seeing the stresses of migration, not just in this region, but all over the world. And I, you know, it's a politically contentious issue. But I would like to point out that there are a lot of social services that newly arrived migrants cannot access. And I think there's quite a bit of misunderstanding there in the general public about what kinds of resources people are able to tap into when they get here. A newly arrived migrant is not going to be able to access Medicaid. Their child is not going to be able to access free or reduced lunch in the school system. It's going to be very difficult for them to find housing without a social security number. There's a lot of helping from within the community going on right now. People doing what they can with the little that they have. But I do think there needs to be a bigger conversation about how we prevent larger humanitarian issues in our communities as we see more people arriving in acute need.
And that's partly where, Dee, your organization, Camino Health, comes in, because in April, you provide low-cost health care to uninsured and underinsured individuals, including the immigrants arriving here. And in April, you had begun to see an increase in people with no family arriving here, as I think you've already mentioned. But that increase, to me, was amazing. It's 300% more people prior to the end of Title 42. And you were anticipating a larger wave once Title 42 expired. Why are they coming here? This is so far away from the southern border. How do they make their way to Charlotte? How do they find themselves? Are they being sent here?
So I will tell you that perspective. So in April, from January to April, we were averaging 9 individuals a week. And so the last 14 days, the first 7 days, we had 41 individuals. And just last week, we had 65. And so what we've seen is most of them are arriving on bus. And I think a lot of them are coming to North Carolina and specifically Charlotte, because we do have an immigration court, but we're also a welcoming city. And so where other cities like Denver or Chicago have resources, their resources are overburdened. And so the next place to go, or the next closest place to go, would be Charlotte, South Carolina, or even Georgia. And so I think that's why we've started seeing the influx here. And Camino has really welcomed them here and set up resources where we're able to really integrate them into the community and prepare them for what Charlotte is. And so I think that's a lot of the reasons, because we are a welcoming city.
But you provide healthcare, and I'm just curious, these people come here with virtually nothing. And as Kayla pointed out a second ago, with no social security number, no access to Medicare, no access to free and reduced lunch if the child is put into school, and I guess many of them are. How do they survive outside of your clinic environment?
So I think this is important to know. So I actually we're a Camino brand, and under Camino, it's Camino Health Center. So we do offer like workforce development under Camino. We have a pastors network through our church, which is about 425 pastors across North Carolina. And we also have educational programs through Camino that really help support the family outside of health. And through our health clinic, we serve the uninsured and the underinsured. And so a lot of that comes through community support, government grants, and then also funding, larger sponsors. And so we're able to serve that population through healthcare, because that's the uninsured and from a community support.
If on average you used to see 9 people a week and now you're seeing 65, mm-hmm. I would imagine you're not alone, that there are other NGOs, non-governmental organizations, who are also helping in this effort, who are seeing something similar. Would that be accurate?
That is absolutely accurate. And I will tell you that between the city and county and non-government agencies, we have been preparing over the last several months in the event that we did have an influx. And so we've had several community partners band together in city and county to start planning and to really support the migrants. Because once they're here, we really want to prevent that homelessness and serve them and serve them well when they're here.
And Kayla, you point out that although we look at the pictures down in El Paso of people sleeping on the streets because they are directly impacted by this numbers of people crossing the border, the reason we are not seeing that, you say, here in Charlotte is because of these non-governmental organizations stepping in to help. How are they helping? What are they doing for these people? Where are they going?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's a couple of organizations I would mention as really having stepped up right now. One is Camino, and also the Latin American Coalition. Those are two of the big actors right now that I see doing a lot with their resources, especially considering that neither of these organizations previously were dealing with homelessness services. We can really kind of think of these two organizations now as being an extension of that homelessness service network that that has been built up around the county. And the Latin American Coalition was granted $2 million in January through the American Rescue Plan Act from Mecklenburg County. That grant is intended to provide emergency services, humanitarian services. And so they've been using that funding to help people find housing in the short term. In emergency cases, that might mean putting someone up in a hotel for the time being if a home cannot be found. They also mentioned that people are being put up in tents in people's backyards, just so that they have somewhere that's not on the street. And I know one of the team members at Camino, Paola Garcia, mentioned that she actually even has a family living with her. And we're hearing more and more stories about that, about this network of the immigrant community and the immigrant serving organizations getting really, really creative to try to find places for people.
As we've said, most of the people coming across now do not have any families to come and be with. And the reason we mention that is because our immigration system has traditionally depended on bringing people from outside the country who have relatives here in this country. These people do not, because they are refugees seeking asylum. But when they bring, we also know when they come, many of them, if not most of them, are women and small children. So when they arrive, these children need to go to school. And I'm just curious, Kayla, how the schools are coping. Have they been granted additional resources? Because these students may not speak English. They may not have safe housing. They may not have access to 3 square meals a day. And we know that children who are hungry cannot learn. And they also may be suffering from trauma or stress from what they experienced in their home countries and what they experienced on their way to Charlotte. So have the schools been given a helping hand, additional resources?
That's another good question. And I know that the schools, CMS is stepping up behind the scenes in certain ways. I spoke to actually Camino recently about a family that from Venezuela that was facing homelessness, and they worked with CMS and social workers at CMS to help find a solution for them, get them into temporary housing so that the children would be able to finish the school year. And, you know, I know there's outreach efforts to educate families on the need to enroll kids in schools, that they must enroll their children in schools. In terms of any additional funding allocations, that is something that I would need to look into, because I haven't heard whether there have been increased funds allocated to the school system, but I do know that there are people working behind the scenes the best they can to provide social services and other support to keep kids in school.
Both Dee from Camino and Jamila Espinosa, an attorney in immigration, have something to say about what we were just talking about with the kids coming here and going to school, etc. We'll get to those questions or those comments in a moment. And I want to find out who these people are, because we often hear about what they're accused of being, and that is not the truth. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about immigration and migration from our countries south of our border, and the expiration of Title 42 and what that may mean, not only for states bordering Mexico, but our state, because a lot of them end up here. As I think Dee said earlier in the program, we have an immigration court, which I want to talk about in a second. Dee John is here. She is director of the Community Outreach and Development for Camino Health. Jamila Espinosa is an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law, and Kayla Young is a Report for America reporter for WFAE News and La Noticia. Both Dee and Jamila wanted to comment on what we were talking about with Kayla just before the break, and that is how the schools are dealing with this influx of people coming into the system from south of our border. Dee, go ahead.
I think what's really important to know is that CMS has been at the table in preparing and planning for this. And some of the resources that, although school is ending in just a couple of weeks, CMS has committed to helping us go ahead and register kids through the summer and get them into programming to help them learn English over the course of the summer, so that when they do start the school year, that they've already had that education through the summer. And so while I don't know what the finances look like for CMS, they have stepped up and they have been at the table preparing for this influx and supporting the community as it arrives here in Charlotte.
Jamila.
Yeah, and Kayla touched on this, on how we're supporting, you know, and how is it that migrants that are arriving here, the children and the mothers that have no one here, and it's been those nonprofit organizations. And it's actually months ago, due to the recent arrivals at the Latin American Coalition and in partnership with Camino and other organizations, started a meeting, Zoom meetings, because there was such an influx. And so what we always say is, we have not had a visualization of a bus arrive of Charlotte, but we have those numbers. We have had busloads and busloads of migrants arrive to Charlotte, just not all at once. But every week, Camino sees it and the Latin American Coalition sees it, people arriving with absolutely nothing. And I think you touched on this, Mike, on how do they arrive to Charlotte? One is an app. There's actually an application that we don't know who created it, that at the border, there's an app that they can put in, and it will show, okay, you're going towards North Carolina, or you should go towards North Carolina, or sometimes they are gifted bus passes to North Carolina, and that's how they make it here. And that app will have the Latin American Coalition. Catholic Charities has actually received migrants with Catholic Charities information on it. Catholic Charities has actually been housing migrants at their cost, thousands of dollars in hotels, because their information was provided to migrants on their actual immigration documentation. How they arrive here is just different ways, but it's been those nonprofits that have been stepping up to support those families.
Kayla.
So, yeah, I wanted to touch on the topic of, you know, how do people end up in Charlotte? And there's a few different ways. One thing I did want to mention is that we don't just have people arriving from the border. We also see effects of hostile anti-immigrant policies in other states. So we do have new arrivals in North Carolina from places like Florida, where people aren't viewing it as safe to be an undocumented person right now. And, you know, migrants, immigrants, they talk. They have their own communication channels, their own, you know, WhatsApp groups, different ways that they connect with each other. And so different places get a reputation. People know, they have a sense of what's going on. I've been impressed to learn about, you know, there are even communication networks of helpers along the way. People who would like to step up, they know that there's a bus coming from whatever city, and people will actually meet migrants at bus stations to check in on them.
Kayla just mentioned there are states where immigrants know that perhaps they are not welcome. Many of them, like Florida, are Republican controlled. And I have to say that although fear of, and demonization of the other apparently is a human trait, much of this demonization of these migrants is coming from people on the right. They have been accused of being criminals and rapists and desperados of one sort or another. From your experience, who are these people?
So that is a great question, and I'm happy to answer that. I actually want to give you a perspective based on a story. So over the last week, we had 65 migrants come to Camino that have just arrived in the United States. And each of them that we have assisted have asked for nothing. But also what's really important is they want to give back. They just don't want to take. And so even helping like process donations and mow our lawn and all of those things, they have been willing to step up and ask if they could do that without us even soliciting that. And so even yesterday, I had 10 of them on campus wanting to volunteer in some capacity until they were able to give back or be integrated fully into the community. So I think it's important for people to understand that when they're coming through the border and they're seeking asylum, they're trying to go through the proper processes. And I would say that most people that are criminals in some capacity, they would not try to go through normal processes and really do it the right way. And so it's important to recognize that they're here, they want a better opportunity, they want to serve and be a part of the community. And so the percentage of people that we're working with every single day, they're not that myth of being criminals and in gangs, and they're just trying to really support their family and be part of a community.
And in fact, would it be accurate to say that they are actually fleeing gangs and criminal activity? That's why they're making the trip.
Absolutely. And I would say 90% of the individuals that we are working with, they're fleeing that violence or persecution or for religious reasons. And so it's important for us to recognize that and really support them as they're making that journey in here in the United States.
Given the crisis that people down south of our border are experiencing, this is probably a separate issue, and I'm not even sure fixing our immigration system, which everybody agrees needs to be fixed. Let Republicans, Democrats, left, right, everybody's in agreement on that. They just can't seem to make it happen. I'm not sure fixing it would help this situation, but as I understand it, Jamila, our immigration system is geared toward granting up to 675,000 permanent immigrant visas each and every year, but it sets no limit on the annual admission of U.S. citizen spouses, parents, and children under 21. So the 675,000 people receiving permanent visas here are supposed to bring with them skills valuable to the economy or people who are refugees. And these are the people we're talking about right now. Do we fill that quota? Do we exceed that quota in an average year?
We do not fill it. So we're backlogged. It's not enough. That is largely what attributes sometimes people to enter the United States illegally. If you are a U.S. citizen and you're seeking to bring a sibling into the United States, you're waiting sometimes 20 years legally to bring your sibling to the United States. And that's because the immigration laws have not been reformed in so long. The population has grown, but those caps, that's those immigrant visas, they haven't increased those limits. And so what happens is there's a wait list, years and years and years long wait list that is affecting people from being able to legally enter the United States.
And is this allowing this influx of people seeking refugees impacting that? Is it tilting the scales away from what we have normally been willing to accept, people with skills, people with family members, and putting them on the back burner to allow people in an emergency situation to come in? Is it having an impact?
Not really, because they're different categories. They're completely different categories. But what it is impacting the resources. The government just has not, the federal government has not put resources into immigration. So the employees, you don't have enough employees working for the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, for the Department of Homeland Security, or for the State Department. So they're different agencies that handle all of these areas. During the pandemic, we saw a huge influx of federal employees retire and also completely, just like in other trades, leave the job altogether. And we just don't have the resources, the finances. The Congress is not funding immigration. And among, you know, we talk about politics, among some of the worst immigration laws were passed under Clinton, among some of the most favorable, almost 2.9 million immigrants were granted green cards under Reagan. It's just, you know, we talk about who gave the best, who gave the worst. The reality is that it's a broken system that has not been fixed in decades, and that's what's attributed to the backlog, the lack of funding, and the lack of actual reform is where we are now at this stage. And now we have this influx of migrants that are crossing illegally, which is because of political unrest, but also because the system is so broken that they don't have the time. They don't feel like they can wait those 20 years for my sibling to petition me.
The Biden administration promised that in the sunset of Title 42, they would have restrictions in place that would handle this. Republicans were very skeptical, but so far, President Biden's transit ban, which has echoes of previous administration's policies in it, seems to be working. The Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy issued a statement in May saying it welcomed the expiration of Title 42, but worried about the Biden administration's transit ban. It also urged the community to consider the humanitarian crisis underlying this fraught political issue. This transit ban, how onerous is it for the people seeking asylum?
It's terrible. It puts us back to the policy that Trump instituted. And so if you did not seek asylum in any of the other countries for which you pass to get to the United States, you would be ineligible for asylum.
Do people mm-hmm. making this journey from Guatemala and Venezuela and other places know the ins and outs of the transit ban? Do they know that they have to stop somewhere else to seek asylum and be rejected to be eligible?
So that's part of what the Department of Homeland Security says that they are putting funneling resources into. Social media campaigns. Kayla talked about WhatsApp. What we're understanding is the Department of Homeland Security's understanding that those are those channels, that they're going to funnel those resources. And Secretary Mayorkas said that is what they're going to be doing, making sure that they are informing the community. But it's a horrible policy. It's a horrible policy because those that are seeking asylum are coming to the United States because they're facing persecution.
But is it working? We had this unanticipated drop, 50% of border crossings. Is it working?
There's a possibility that it is, and largely because of that CBP One app. So if you do the CBP One app, you will not be subject to that transit ban. So if you are able to get a date on that CBP One app, which is that application we talked earlier on the show, and you get an appointment, which means that you still will be put in deportation proceedings. That does not mean that you get a free pass and you get to come into the United States. You still have to apply for asylum and have your claim heard. You would not be subject to. So it's likely. What we do see is that there's a possibility that migrants are waiting and out to see what is going to happen. It may be that in a couple of weeks, we may see an influx, but there's a possibility that's working. We do know that the ACLU has filed a lawsuit. So there may be an injunction coming its way against this transit ban, as what happened during the Trump administration's similar, that they instituted something similar. We'd have to see. There's a possibility that it's working. It also may be a possibility that migrants are seeking to see what's happening.
I have about 3 minutes left, and I want to touch on the fact that Charlotte has an immigration court, and that court covers both North and South Carolina. They hear tens of thousands of immigration cases with only a handful of judges presiding, not enough even in normal times. And this end of Title 42 may put an even greater strain. According to Syracuse University's Track Immigration Database, there are currently 74,219 pending immigration cases in Charlotte, with people waiting an average of 701 days. That's just 1 month shy of 2 years. There is also a high denial rate, 95% of people are denied asylum. You say, Jamila, that does not mean they don't have winnable asylum cases. So what does it mean?
What that means is, unfortunately, the standards for the judges before for which they are appearing for, they do not believe that their claims meet the standards for asylum law. I can have the exact same case before three other courts in the United States, and I have had very similar case sets, political opinion cases, won them in three other states and lose it in Charlotte. And so it's just the judges for which we are before do not believe that those facts meet the standard for which we are able to claim, you know, win asylum here in the United
States. Are they planning to add judges now that Title 42 is over and more people are seeking asylum? Are they planning to
throughout,
do
yes, the Department of Homeland Security has ads throughout the United States. Again, it's also lack of resources. The judges also are facing burnout. I've had colleagues leave the bench because it is a tough job to hear asylum cases when you're facing 72,000 cases right now. We have between four and five judges hearing that many.
Very quickly, Kayla, could there be a silver lining to this, as Title 42 has ended, the transit ban goes into effect, southern border states are sending more people who are crossing the border to other parts of the country, saying, you take them, we can't handle anymore. Could that broaden political pressure for Congress to do something about our broken immigration system? I have a very short amount of time.
I think there's always hope, and you know, having people reach different parts of the country that didn't previously really face immigration in the way border states have, yeah, I do hope that might spark a larger national conversation about how to manage the system humanely and efficiently.
And finally, Dee, you have just one of the many organizations who are working behind the scenes to help these people, people who have nothing. So if people want to help you help them, what's the best way to do it?
So the biggest need right
Quickly.
Now is housing and transportation. You can go to our website at www.camino.org and access information on how you can donate and be a part.
Thank you very much, Dee John with Camino Health, Jamila Espinosa from Espinosa Law, and Kayla Young from us.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producer is Gabe Altieri. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.